So Dan and I promised recently that we would have, we'd kind of finally make good on the promise we made when we started this podcast, and we'd interview more interesting people. And you guys heard John Knobloch last week. We've had a whole bunch of really good ones that Dan's lined up. I'm really excited for this one. I have a reputation for knowing a lot about bikes, but believe it or not, there are actually a few people in the world who like bikes more than me and know more about bikes than me. And I brought one here today. We have a former Maybird rider, a current colleague of mine, Isaac Boyden, who many of you may know. Isaac's been a serious bike racer now for how many years?
I started racing, or like racing competitively, like my sophomore into junior year. So only actually around 4.5, but I've been biking for like 6.5.
Okay. Now this is interesting. This is our second take because I messed up the microphones the first time. I kind of always assumed that you came from a cycling family. I think I was talking to one of our coworkers about this the other day, that cycling's like a culture, and it's something that certain people kind of are born into and are just surrounded by their whole life. This kind of was the case for you, but not really, you were saying.
No, I mean, like, cycling was a part of my family in the way where, like, my dad likes to commute to and from work. He doesn't like driving his car, and he has buddies who mountain bike, and they did the White Room Trail once a year, like, as long as I can remember, and he mountain biked maybe 3 or 4 times a year. I brought cycling into the family when I became absolutely and utterly obsessed with it, not really the other way around. And now everybody likes it, except for my mom. She hates heights, so mountain biking's not her favorite
thing. That's
okay.
That's okay.
Yeah.
But so this is how would you like describe your relationship with cycling? Because I always struggle a little bit when people are like, oh, what do you do for fun? And I almost don't like saying that I ride bikes for fun, because I don't know that fully captures like my feelings about this sport. You know, do you kind of feel that too?
I think that's really, really hard too, because when somebody's like, oh, what do you like to do for fun? They're expecting like a hobby that you do a couple hours a week that you enjoy. But you're like, oh no, I spend 14, 15, you know, some of us are spending 18 hours a week on our bikes.
Right.
That's a lot harder to like comprehend.
Right.
When every day you're like working, you're like, man, how early can I get out of work so I can ride my bike? Or every time you eat, you're like, how's this going to benefit me on the bike? Or sleeping, how everything in your life is also operating around. Well, I guess this is in terms of if you're cycling in a way performance oriented, not so much if you're just cycling for like fun. I guess those are two very different things. But
but you feel that too, like that like I'm a cyclist. I don't cycle for fun. I like reading books for fun and doing other things for like I have we were talking about Legos and stuff. Like I have other hobbies, but this isn't one of them. And so I feel like very seen by you, because I feel like we have a similar take on this. You're much better at it than me.
I wouldn't say that. I've seen you go downhill faster than me.
Well, that's times. I mean, that, you know, I weigh 3 times as much as you do. So
the whole Draper family can manual with one hand, and it makes me mad.
I can't manual anymore. I used to be able to do that, but you've kind of there's two different sides I see in you. One is the very high performance athlete, that you're kind of at a point in your life right now where you're like super, super dialed in on this. But then also is just like the knowledge base, the person who just knows everything about cycling. So I kind of want to dive into both of those. I brought you here today because I really want to talk through some of your thoughts on tech and equipment and stuff.
Yes.
But really quick, just a nod to like, what is your training look like right now? And what are your kind of racing goals for this season?
So I'm currently doing a lot of mountain bike marathon stuff, very long distance. So I'm doing Tahoe Trail, which is only like 2.5-3 weeks from now. That's a 63 miles on the mountain bike. Average finishing time for like the upper like groups is around 4.5 to 5 hours. I'm doing Leadville this year. I got into Leadville, so I'm trying to like do maybe sub 7 hours there. And then I also want to get 2 KOMs on some pretty big loops this year that are popular. So it's definitely higher volume oriented. So currently it is lots of volume, lots of zone 2 training, not really a ton of intensity training. Intensity I save closer to the event. I don't know, a lot of Maybird riders work with like Wukar Fit, a lot of him like his weight training stuff, and I love his ideology. And he jokes about all the time how all of his athletes do way too much intensity work and VO2 work and not enough volume. And I totally agree. So right now it's mainly just a lot of volume. I usually hit anywhere between, I usually average around 16 hour weeks right now. But in the last like 3 months, I have done multiple like weeks that I've gone above 24 hours while working full time.
That's like quite a bit.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
It's a lot of hours. But it's mostly zone 2 stuff, which is easier to recover from as long as you're eating correctly, sleeping correctly. Or I guess not even eating correctly, but just eating enough and sleeping correctly. It's totally doable.
So you say, well, working full time. So you and I are co-workers right now at Contender. Yeah, you've been at Contender for three years?
3.5 years. I started working there when I was 16.
So this is the other side of you. Because you like, not everybody who works in the bike industry rides bikes, which is kind of a thing that surprised me when I got there. Like, not everybody who works at a bike shop goes and rides their bike every single day.
No. There's a lot of people who work at the bike shops all the time get sick of bikes.
Right. So how are you? Are you getting there where you're spending, like, you know, that many hours a week on the bike and working full time at a bike shop, where basically every waking moment in your life is absorbed by cycling in some way, right?
There are points, but usually I'm pretty good about it. I can find a way to separate work and separate bike riding. I think being volume being my focus and not intensity based, and letting bike being an escape helps a lot, because I can be like, oh, I'm off work. I can just go ride my bike, listen to a podcast, listen to some music, and go wherever I want, just pedal slow. Because that's what volume is. The thought of like working a full shift and then, okay, now I have to get off and go do like VO2 work or tempo work, that's a little bit harder.
Right.
So usually I have to time my VO2 and intensity days on like half shifts or instead of like them after a full shift day, because it gets harder. And I usually find my work-life balance in terms of cycling versus work is pretty easy. But not everybody is as utterly obsessed about cycling, I would say. I feel like for a lot of people, if you work within the industry, you get off work and the last thing you want to do is touch and work on another bike. But I find it thoroughly relaxing, but not everybody does at that point.
So what is your job right now?
So my official title, according to Contender, is Digital Marketing Specialist and / Rider Care, which is extremely pretentious. But so mainly I'm on the sales floor during the summer, and then during slow season / winter, I also do most of our blog posts. I do tech reviews. I ride bikes and test them, review them. I do YouTube, do media. I do a lot of stuff on the website side of things, including like how we see like customers' orders, bring them and talk to customers. But during the busy season, it more ends up just being on the sales floor because we're so busy. There's not a whole ton of time for that stuff. I occasionally go to product launches and releases and like take my notes and write-ups on those. And occasionally, Ryan, our owner, has me build bikes when he needs something to build a bike and there's not a time in the schedule.
Because I was going to say that I've seen a couple times that, like, situations where Ryan's been like, I remember one where he was like, here's a BMC frame, go build a bike for this guy, just go pick stuff out. That, like, he has that, like, level of trust in you to just go and build a bike for someone. Like, that's pretty unique. I don't know that I've met a whole lot of people in the cycling industry who are versatile enough to, like, know the stuff and work on the stuff. And I think that probably makes you one of the best rounded people I've run into. Is that just because you are a racer and kind of a mechanic and know your stuff sales-wise? Like,
a big portion of it was I really, really like my entire life. I like pulling crap apart and putting it back together and figuring out how it works. And so when I started cycling, that involved my bikes. During COVID, when I like nobody wanted to go to a bike shop because they made you wait outside until you could go in. I learned how to fix stuff myself, and it meant that a lot of my bikes were broken a lot of the time. But eventually I figured that out, doing a lot of stuff just myself until now. And also a big part of that is all the racing, cycling, everything I do is on my own salary and not anybody else's. So a big part of that is the gear I choose while trying to be a high performance racer who's competitive and signing up, you know, Cat 1, Men's Pro and things like that, but also on my own dollar. It means that I do a lot more research into the gear I choose. What is the best, like, performance versus money gain? So I think that that is a very big factor in terms of, like, money versus like product.
So this is what I'm excited about. I want to drill in with you to kind of choices that are relevant to cross country mountain bikers in particular.
Yeah.
I think I'll ask a couple questions about other stuff, but to start, when you have a parent who goes mountain biking and could kind of talk about mountain bikes a little bit, maybe knows the difference between like a 29er and a 27.5, and maybe even knows how much suspension travel their bike has, talking to someone at that kind of level, what would you say are the really important things that you need to worry about when you're shopping for a bike or for bike parts or making choices about your equipment? And then what are some things that you are less worried about?
I think people were worried about too much if their bike has electronic shifting or not. Okay. Electronic shifting is extremely nice, and a lot of new bikes have it, but it shouldn't be your only priority. I think people need to be most concerned, I think, in terms of like a bike that's going to be comfortable for them. It's going to actually suit their needs, and it's not either not enough bike or too much bike for what they're doing. It's a bike that actually fits them well, and it's because sometimes you see those deals that are only on this one bike in this one size, and maybe it's too small or too big for you. Making sure the bike fits well, and don't let that cloud your judgment. And then making sure, I would say, especially in the cross-country world, It's not all cross country bikes can clear big tires. Make sure a bike can clear a big tire, because I think a 2.4 is like the best thing you can do. That's less of a problem now. That was more like something I had to look at like 2.5-3 years ago. Most modern XC bikes, that's not an issue. But I think not letting price point cloud your judgment, or like,
and what do you mean by that?
Is I think, especially right now in the bike industry with how many sales are going on, make sure that what you're buying isn't, you're not buying it because like, oh, this is a really nice bike at a good price. Maybe I should just get this, versus, oh, well, yes, that's awesome, but that bike maybe has a little bit more travel than what you're looking for. Stick with the bike that's actually going to suit your needs, even if it's deal. I mean, obviously spend what you want to spend. Don't go over that budget.
Right.
But maybe even if it's not as good of a deal as you're looking for.
So when you say is right for you, when somebody comes into the shop and says, hey, I'm a Nike racer, like what are you, what is the right bike for them? Or what kind of category should they be looking at, and why? Because like cross country bikes aren't what they used to be.
No,
you
know, not.
So like two bikes that I could maybe give you, like what really makes a Santa Cruz Blur TR and a Santa Cruz Tallboy that different? Because they have almost the same amount of travel. Mm-hmm. Both of them have a carbon fiber frame.
Exactly.
What? So those, the, but those two bikes are vastly different, right?
And that's a great example, because that's something you see a lot of things happening in like Nike and Nike industries. You see a lot of Nike racers ending up something that's really similar to a cross country bike, but it's not quite what they're looking for. I mean, if you're a Nike racer who likes to go out and like maybe Nike is not your priority and you really just want to have fun on trails, go for it by all means. Like, do what you want to do. But if you are prioritizing racing, especially if you're racing also outside of Nike, you really want to be careful not to end up on something like a Tallboy. Tallboy is a fantastic bike. It's not great for a Nike rider. Same thing you see with the Scott Spark versus Spark RC.
Right. So what's the peril there? What's gonna happen if that Nike racer who's concerned about performance gets on the Tallboy or the normal Spark or any, I mean, that's like the most popular segment site. I could list 50 bikes.
Tons and tons of bikes in those range.
What are you actually worried about?
The biggest thing that comes to that is I don't think people realize how much extra, travel or like suspension that's tuned a little bit differently actually makes a difference on the trail. The Tallboy is a great example of that, because instead of using a flex state design like the Blur does, it uses a VPP suspension design. And on the frame alone, not including other bike parts, you're adding on like 3 pounds to the weight of the bike.
Wow.
It's a lot. Like when you're talking frame to frame, that's a lot of weight. And then you add in the fact that that Tallboy, even though it travels almost the same as a Blur TR, is also going to come spec'd with bigger brakes. It's going to come spec'd with bigger tires, more dropper post. It's going to come spec'd with a different stem and bar combination, all those things. And overall, you're going to put a bike where, like, let's say you spent $8,000 on a Blur or $8,000 on a Tallboy. That's kind of a high price point.
Sure.
But at the exact same price point, you're going to end up with a bike that weighs 6 pounds more.
Okay, so let's do a little exercise here. I am going to be every customer ever, okay? so what you said, 3 pounds more on the frame, maybe 6 pounds more overall. So,
yeah.
Oh, well, you know, I could probably lose 6 pounds. That's 6 pounds is nothing. You know, I weigh 180 pounds.
Yeah.
What's your response to that?
I think the biggest thing that people realize, obviously, if like, let's say you're getting into cycling to lose some weight and you want to be more fit, good for you, and you're not going to notice it as much.
Sure.
But most Nike racers are not that. Most Nike racers are high schoolers whose metabolism is so fast, no matter how much they ate, they are a stick.
Right.
I was that way in high school. I still kind of am now, and that's the way a lot of high schoolers are. And that bike weight is a big portion of your mass. The other thing to go along with that is if your body weight is so-and-so, you use that body weight every day to do everything you do. You are so used to the way your own body feels that you are not going to notice 3 pounds off your body as much as you will off the bike. Then again, I also think that chasing pounds on a bike is also kind of like whatever, because there's only so much weight you can get off a bike before you actually notice a difference. But
so
we can do more on that later.
Weight aside, let's say we have a hypothetical where somebody's looking at, they find they can afford maybe an entry-level Blur, or they found a 3-4-year-old Tallboy that has much better components and weighs the same. Weight is the same between the two. What are your thoughts?
That's a hard choice, because the Tallboy from 3 or 4 years ago is very different than the Tallboy of today.
Okay, let's, for the sake of this question, let's say they happened to get a crazy hookup on a tall boy from today, like, right? Let's say basically, what if the weight between those two bikes is the same for the same price?
The biggest thing you got to think about is what the bike was designed for. I mean, Santa Cruz knows what they're doing. They're one of my favorite bike companies ever, and they really, really know how to design a bike. The Santa Cruz Tallboy is not designed for the same thing as a Blur TR, even though their travel numbers are similar. In terms of geometry, the Tallboy is going to sit you like you're climbing on top of the bike, while the Blur is going to make you climb as if you're inside the bike. The Tallboy is going to be able to be pushed way harder in a descent than the Blur, even though it's around the same travel number. And the Blur... But the Blur actually descends pretty close to what the Tallboy can do. It just tends to get sketched out in the rear end because it can't hold the same traction as a VPP suspension system. But along with wheelbase, reach, stack height, and stack height's actually a really big thing that mountain bikers don't really pay attention to a whole ton.
What is stack height?
So stack height is a measurement. Oh, yeah, I guess we should reference that. So stack height is if you were to draw a line through your bottom bracket perfectly parallel to a ground and draw another parallel line perfectly parallel to the ground through your head tube, where like right where your headset sits, that measurement from the top of your head tube to the bottom bracket equals stack height.
Okay.
Most people don't really pay attention to it in the mountain bike world because it's kind of whatever. But it actually makes a really big difference on XC bikes because we climb so much. For most mountain bikers, climbing is climbing and you just kind of do it to get done with it. But for XC riders, we're worried about actually our performance and speed on the climbs. And a bike with a stack height that's too high, you can't get enough weight over the front wheel. And then you feel like you need to stand up and get up and over the bars to get enough weight to get power out. And then your rear wheel starts slipping out. Traction equals speed, which is, I think, a big thing a lot of people forget about. If you're losing traction, you are losing efficiency and speed. It's the same reason why a full suspension is actually faster on a technical climb than a hardtail. Even though you're climbing, the full suspension is still faster because it's got better traction. But a cross-country bike's got a significantly lower stack height than almost any like low-travel trail bike like the normal Spark or like a Tallboy or anything else in that range. And that stack height makes a really, really big difference to the way the rider sits on the bike and can push into it. That weight on the front end makes a huge difference in a cross-country race. And I think that's a really big thing that is not super apparent when you read a lot of reviews about mountain bikes.
So, okay, so you've convinced me. I'm going to buy a cross-country bike. Obviously, as an employee of Contender, your job is to sell the bikes that Contender sells. How much do you care about, you know, maybe not for you but for somebody that you're advising, Scott versus a Santa Cruz versus a Cervelo versus a Yeti versus a Specialized versus a Cannondale versus a Trek versus anything else? How important do you think brand should be when you're considering which bike to buy?
Most of the time, not very, but each brand has unique things to the brand that can suit different riders more. Riders who really want to, because I think something that a lot of people make fun of but is a big deal is a lot of riders want a bike that looks really, really good.
Sure.
If you don't like the way the bike looks, you're not gonna be as motivated to ride it. A bike you love and a bike you look and go, yeah, that's a really good looking bike, I want to go ride that bike, you're gonna spend more time on it. And if you really, really like certain looks on certain bikes, like there's like Scott is really all about integration and the way their bike looks, and they want to make their bike look fantastic, and so that could be something really prioritized to a rider. While as Santa Cruz, their whole thing is serviceability and reliability. Normal bottom brackets, normal headsets, easy to route, easy to cable, no nonsense, no fuss. If a lot of riders who are working on their own bikes, that make a much bigger difference to them. There's some companies like Orbea who are all on their XC bikes are like pretty much about all about speed. They will do things that make their bikes faster. They honestly kind of sit in exactly the polar opposites of the cross country world that Scott and Santa Cruz sit on. Orbea sits in between them, right? So every company has their own quirks that will suit an individual rider well. But I would say any person looking for a modern cross country bike could buy a modern cross country bike with the same intent from almost any company and be happy with it.
It'll work as
it will intended. Work with it. Exactly. But it is one of those things also is that you don't know what you don't know.
Right.
So if you ride this one cross country bike that you bought and you love it to death for yourself, you're never going to know anything better. But it's one of those things that you might not know something's better until you ride it. And then you go, oh, I do like this or I don't like this. But for the vast majority of people, what a cross country bike you end up buying, you'll end up really, really liking. I don't think companies should be a play into your decision point. I think you should be open to all options and discuss and like what you actually like best and what suits you best, not just company.
So what are you riding right now?
I'm currently riding a Cervelo ZFS, very similar to a Santa Cruz Blur. I was on the Santa Cruz Blur before. those bikes are almost the same. They share a linkage. They share a progression curve in the rear end. They share similar geometry, but not quite the same.
And part
they
of,
share,
we should say they're part of the same company.
They Santa are part Cruz of the same.
So Cervelo Pond Hold- owned by the same.
Yeah. So company. Pond Holdings owns Santa Cruz, Cervelo, GT, Cannondale, Reserve Wheels. They own everything.
Yeah, they own a bunch of
cycling companies. They own a ton of cycling companies.
So there's a lot of similarities between the Blur and the Cervelo, but I have heard you say to people they are distinct bikes.
They are distinctly different. That's actually one of my biggest pet peeves about people sometimes we work with is when they don't quite understand something. And they'll be like, oh yeah, it's pretty much just a Blur. It's not. It's not the same thing. Though, I will say that's why I bought it. The Santa Cruz Blur, I think, is one of the best XC bikes on the market, period, and I loved mine to death. And by the time I was like, oh, I'm kind of ready for a switch up because I'm totally stuck in that hole if I work in the bike industry and I can get new bikes. And that's a hole that a lot of people in the bike industry are. And I was like, oh, it's kind of time for a switch up. I want a new bike. I like the Blur so much that I decided to get the Cervelo ZFS thinking it was just going to be another Blur. I bought mine a month before they released it and started riding it and testing it before they released it.
So you bought the bike before you had the opportunity to ride it?
Absolutely. My Cervelo ZFS was the first Cervelo ZFS in Utah and only one of four that had been sold to customers in the United States for the first 3 months that bike was released. And then there was that huge sale, and then everybody's got one, right? They're all over the place now. But for a while, yes. I mean, it was kind of a leap. And I took that leap knowing that the designers had taken the same notes off the Santa Cruz Blur and that the geometry was similar and they had similar designers and designers that worked together. So I was like, it's probably going to be similar to a Blur. I can trust it. That's one of the things where I was okay buying it without riding it because I had ridden a bike.
You kind of knew roughly
I kind of roughly knew it was going to be like. And that's the thing is I bought that bike thinking it was going to be identical to a Blur. And I was like, in my head, I was like, yeah, so I'm getting something different, but it's the same as a bike I already dearly love. Therefore, it's going to be fine. And I think that was the biggest shock to me is when I bought it and rode it, and it was so different. I was, like, blown away because I thought it was going to be the same.
So looking back, do you like your Cervelo more, or do you think the Blur was better?
I think they do different things in different places. I think if I wasn't as heavy as a racer, I still would prefer a Blur. The Cervelo is a better descender than the Blur is. It's a little bit slacker on the front end, and it feels more composed. But the Blur feels more right as like an all-around rider and not so much as a racer, because the Cervelo poises you on top of the bike like a racer does. It's got race DNA in it because it's meant to be a race bike.
So that's interesting. So yeah. You say the Cervelo descends better, but that it also climbs better. But you said the Blur's better for an all-around rider.
There's a couple things to that. Headset routing on the Cervelo. Headset routing, I am iffy on, and I think any bike that's not a dedicated XC race bike in the mountain bike world and up should never have headset routing. Headset routing is stupid. Scott, I'm looking at you. But that new Cannondale Scalpel, the cables through the bar. That's so ugly. Yeah. That's awful. People should not do that.
So you're not into that?
I'm not into that. The bike itself is really, really cool, but I do not like the headset.
Would that be like a deal breaker for you?
Absolutely.
Really?
I think the new Cannondale Scalpel is actually like one of like the coolest XC bikes on the market, and the deal breaker for me is the headset routing.
Interesting.
But because it goes right through the bar, and I think that's ridiculous.
So the Blur and the ZFS, do they have different headset routing?
Yes, so the Blur is standardized. The Blur is exactly like every other Santa Cruz, and it's like every other mountain bike, where it is a standard. It's called IS headset, which is integrated standard, IS for short, 4152. That is the headset size that is used in Santa Cruz Blur, which is the headset size shared by like 65, 70% of bikes on the market in terms of just like generalized mountain bikes, which is awesome. Santa Cruz loves making nothing proprietary. They've used the same headset on their bikes for like the better part of 4 years. Every single model on their bikes share the same headset. The Cervelo ZFS uses a bigger headset because it's got headset routing through the upper. It needs to have a bigger upper bearing to fit cables through it. So it's made by FSA and it comes with every bike, but it's one of those things where it's harder to work on because the cables are running through the front. So that is more racer oriented. It does create a clean cockpit. And I will say when I'm in longer rides, it's nice because I can hold my hands on my handlebars and don't worry about cables getting in the way. And it looks good. But the Blur is easier to work on by like a long shot. I would say like if I were to do a headset bearing replacement, you've been sweating on your bike all season and those headset bearings are crunching, I'd replace them. If I were to do that personally myself, just in my garage, replace the headset bearings on my ZFS versus a Blur, it'd probably take me 45 minutes longer to do on a ZFS. And you also have to include, you might have to rebleed your brakes afterwards.
So someone though, maybe someone listening to this who does not work on their bikes at all, should you worry about headset routing?
Not really. If you don't work on your bikes at all, I don't think really that matters that much, because you're just going to bring it into a shop anyways, and they're well equipped to deal with it.
Okay.
I to a certain extent, I definitely think the ZFS is actually unique, because it's, I think, one of the best headset routing situations to deal with, even if you don't like mechanic, because let's say you're not a racer, but you do want to be comfortable on a bike. You want to try different cockpits, different spacer situations, move things around. There's nothing proprietary on the cockpit side of the Cervelo ZFS except for the headset routing. You can run whatever spacers, whatever stem, whatever bar you want. Does not matter. A Scott Spark, however, uses proprietary spacers, bar, spacer setup, everything. So, like, that makes fitting bikes, and if you want to change stem and bar space, like, change to a different stem length, that makes that way harder. So I would say with the Cervelo especially, it's way easier to deal with. The more proprietary the bike is on the front end, the more that can get annoying, even if you don't work on your own bikes, because you're just trying to get, like, something to fit right and you can't. The Blur is the simplest because there's no headset routing and no proprietary cockpit. Throw whatever you want on there.
So I want to go back to we were making the comparison between the ZFS and the Blur, and we talked about the Cervelo being slacker. And if I realize I should probably explain, we say slacker, we're talking about the head tube angle.
Head tube angle.
Basically, how far in front of you the wheel is.
So it's like how tucked underneath the frame the wheel is. The steeper head tube angle on a bike, the more tucked underneath the bike the front wheel is going to be.
And what is the effect of that?
So on the Cervelo versus, but on a lot of cross-country bikes, it's actually not terribly different. Like a Scott Spark is like 67.2, 67.3, I think. It's one of those two. And then Orbea Oise is 67 flat, and then a Blur TR is 67.1. Those are all within like 0.2 of each other.
And the bigger the number, the bigger the number,
the steeper the head tube angle. A Cervelo ZFS is 66.6 on the 120 mil. It's half a degree slacker than the Blur, over half a degree slacker than the Spark. It's a much bigger difference than the rest of XC bikes, and with the exception of like the Epic Evo, just the standard Epic, it's one of the slackest XC bikes that we carry at the shop.
So out on the trail, how does that feel different?
I mean, the biggest difference I noticed is that it means you have to stand more upright on the bike and more over the front end, because you need to have a little bit more prowess on the front end of the bike. It's the best way to put it is when you corner on the Santa Cruz Blur, it feels super natural. You rip a corner, you just go right through it. That slacker front end on that bike means you have to be a little bit more over the front end to corner the same way to get as a Blur. It wants to like do this a little bit. Like I remember the first time I ripped into a corner my ZFS thinking it was going to be the exact same as my Blur and didn't. And went full speed, full gas, should not have. That stupid. Don't do that. When you buy a new bike, learn how it rides. And I went boop. Right off the edge.
Really?
Yeah.
So this is because I always say to people that like the slacker head tube angle makes the bike more stable.
It does make it more stable, but it also doesn't make it as more nimble. Agile.
Yeah.
So specifically in corners, a slacker head tube angle does not corner as well with, I mean, obviously some exceptions of like traction and stuff. Like we can go into trail bikes, but that's a whole other story. But between cross country bikes, a slacker head tube angle does not corner as well. It corners really well because all cross-country bikes corner well. They've got short wheelbases compared to like most other mountain bikes.
Right.
But you have to be more on top of it. You have to be sitting with more of your weight over the front end and your butt kind of more in the air and less in like a full attack position on like a slacker head tube XC bike versus a steeper head tube angle XC bike. That's the other thing about the Santa Cruz Blur versus the Cervelo ZFS is the way the rear end functions is different. So even though they technically have the same leverage ratios and the same linkage, they can even share shock between the two, like the shock tune is the same. The rear end in a Cervelo is springier. Its carbon layup is designed differently, which means that its suspension doesn't ramp up as fast, which means when you go into a corner, you have to be sitting up a little bit more because you don't have the same braking traction, which is unique. So it's something you have to learn, and that's another thing that sets those two bikes apart.
So talking about like the slacker front end on this ZFS and the rear end, what is the upside of those? Because those kind of sound like complications to me. But you're saying you've told me that like the ZFS is still the best bike on the market right now. I've heard you say that to people before.
In terms of cross country bikes, if I were to buy any cross country bike right now, I'm pretty tied between another ZFS, a Blur, or honestly the new Specialized Epic.
Okay.
Before we started carrying Specialized, I was a Specialized hater just because we didn't carry them. And I mean, I'd ridden them before and I did like them a lot, but it was just like, oh, Specialized is that thing I just don't have to worry about because we don't carry them. And then we started carrying them and I started riding them in terms of reviewing, not just riding them because my friends rode one and like I stole it for a lap or two. And I do truly think that the current Specialized Epic 8 is a fantastic XC bike.
So you mentioned that one and the ZFS as being slacker, what is the upshot of that? What's the payoff? Because it's more complicated.
Yes,
corner
it
like
is.
That.
It is.
Why have it then?
Sorry, I got totally distracted.
No, you're good.
The upshot is how you can descend comfortably. I think this is a really big thing, especially in long distance events or tougher courses. I don't know how many people listen to this, like watch XC, but like recently in like last week, there was the Crans Montana XC course in the Swiss Alps, which was so incredibly technical. Things like that. If anybody here has raced like the Fayetteville, Arkansas XCO course before they took the dropout, and a couple of like those courses in there, the UCI courses, like, I mean, if you decide to sign up for the UCI course, even as a Maybird rider, like the U23 UCI stuff at like Fayetteville, you're still doing some pretty gnarly stuff. And that slacker head tube angle lets the bike do more of the work for you. You can kind of let go of the brakes a little bit and let the bike do its thing. And in an XCO race, that matters a lot because it means you have more time to like actually actively recover on the descents and not worry so much about your line choice. So you can come into the next climb feeling more refreshed. Same thing if you're doing longer distance events, you can let the bike do more of the work for you, so you don't need to worry about it, active recovery, which also means you're way less fatigued at the end of a long ride, which is why... that's why so many cross-country riders have been like moving over to 120 millimeters to travel, and why 120 mils of travel became the norm in the cross-country marathon world first before cross XCO or XC Olympic style racing, because fatigue was a way bigger deal for them because they're on the bike for way longer. And Cervelo ZFS is also... I like to get a little hectic on my XC bikes more than sometimes you should. And the longer wheelbase and slacker head angle lets you take chunk with a little bit more prowess. You can kind of let go and let the bike do its thing over chunk and float it. And you can be more worried about what's coming up next and less about your line choice within the chunk.
So
well.
Every single Pink Bike article for the past like 7 or 8 years at this point has just said every new bike is longer, lower, slacker. You hear
yes.
that? Every new, and that's the kind of, and it really is true that like mm-hmm. the new X is, you know, longer, lower, and slacker by this much than the old one, right?
Yeah.
We talked about slacker here. When people say longer and lower, referring to like stack and reach, how does that actually affect you on the trail? Like maybe compare the 2018 blur to the 2024 blur.
The biggest thing that people got to think about is when people say longer and lower, lower is usually not a reference to stack height in the world of mountain biking. It's a reference to the bottom bracket.
Right.
The lower the bottom bracket on your bike is, the more stable you are as a rider. Your center of gravity lowers and you feel more planted. I would say the reason why bottom brackets have been getting lower for stability is just because mountain bike geometry started off being designed straight off of road bikes and road bike. And also as cranks have gotten shorter, we can go to lower bottom brackets for stability without worrying so much about crank strikes. I think as cranks are getting shorter for most people, if you like to ride shorter cranks. I think the biggest thing that people got to think about though is that the reason bikes are getting longer, which is usually referenced to the reach of a bike, which right. is if you draw a line straight up from the bottom bracket and then a line straight up through the hot through the head to perpendicular to the ground, that measurement and distance between those two is your reach. The reason reach is getting longer is a direct correlation of head tube angle. As bikes get slacker, your reach needs to get longer to compensate for that. Mainly,
why is that?
So that's the other thing to keep in mind with reach is reach does not take into account seat tube angle, which is, I think, a big thing that people forget. Your seat tube sits behind your bottom bracket, which means that the angle of reach isn't, seat tube is not taken into account. So yes, reaches have been getting longer and longer and longer, but seat tube angles have also been getting steeper, bringing your seat tube farther upwards, which also means your physical like tip of saddle to center of bar has not changed that much.
Okay.
It has gotten longer, yes, but not as much as people think it is, because that reach number does not reflect seat tube angle at all.
So the question I'm kind of leading up to here is, a lot of times I have people ask me, buying new bike versus used bike, right? Where they're like,
yeah.
I could get, maybe yeah. I have $5,000 to spend, so I could get yeah. a Santa Cruz Blur S, right?
Yeah.
Or I found this 2018 previous gen Santa Cruz Blur that was the XX1 top of the line model for $5,000. We could do any other bike brand, basically, right?
Yeah.
Setting aside maybe the like wear and tear that's associated with used bikes, just talking about like the geometry and the amount of travel, maybe saying a hypothetical used bike from 2018 that's got, you know, 100 mils of travel and a 69 degree head tube angle versus the modern version that's 120 mils of travel and a 66.5 degree head tube angle or something like that. do you, like for an Iker racer, do you think that it's worth maybe accepting a bike that's slightly heavier and has slightly more entry level components to get the newer geometry and travel setup?
That's really hard. Mainly, I think if you're looking to race outside of Nike, yes, absolutely get the newer bike. But that's harder specifically just within Nike because Nike courses aren't very technical. That is something I think Nike needs to work on. They need to make their courses a little bit more technical. That's my personal opinion. I think Nike courses need to be more technical. But because they're so smooth in their overall profile, a full modern like 120 mil mountain bike isn't 100% what a Nike racer would be the fastest on if you're just looking at flat out speed. The Santa Cruz Blur from 4 years ago might actually be a faster bike with super nice parts on it than I think the current like Santa Cruz Blur. But it's as soon as you start wanna doing trails outside of just the actual Nike course, like
which
you
is
have
most
fun,
of which what is, Nike racers still do, right?
Yes, isn't, right.
Most Nike racers don't just do 5 bike rides a year that happen to be races.
Exactly, right? Exactly. I think that's an argument of whether your goal is all out speed on a Nike course or if you still wanna have fun outside. Because there's a lot of trails you can do just in your average day to day training, which are significantly more technical than Nike course and a modern cross country bike.
And I would argue that you should be exposing yourself.
Oh, for sure, 100%. Especially if you ever want to race. If you ever want to race like races outside of Nike, they're going to be way more technical as well. I think a big part of this is actually suspension design, and geometry follows suspension design. Short travel suspension in the last like 4 years, 3 years maybe, even though it's like 3 years, has taken a crazy jump. Like if you look at like the RockShox Cid right now versus RockShox Cid from 4 years ago, they are so different. It is mind-blowing. That hasn't so much happened on the trail and enduro side of things. It's specifically cross-country short travel has gotten way more capable, which means that cross-country bikes have been able to get slacker and longer without and get more travel without thinking about how much extra weight or efficiency they're losing with that, because cross-country suspension has gotten more and more capable without as much weight penalty and has gotten more efficient in the rear end as well. Suspension design has changed a lot in the way where now we can make like an efficient flex day bike on 120 mil that doesn't feel like it's super springy in the rear end. And so like a current Santa Cruz Blur, like you brought up, like versus the old one, is no longer VPP and is flex day in the rear with 115 millimeters of travel.
So maybe like the Scalpel would have been a better example then. Because the Blur is kind of a bad example. We had a suspension change. The Scalpel uses the same suspension
design. It uses the same suspension design.
Going back
way back.
Yeah.
The Scalpel is unique because it's a very, very short, snappy, little skippy bike.
Right.
The modern Scalpel is significantly slacker and longer. Again, like we've been talking about.
With every other bike
than the old Scalpel. And I think that the old Scalpel is incredibly fun in the way it's kind of scary. It is a squirrely bike. And I say if you like to be very precise with your lines, and I know some people are, then maybe a Scalpel might be the bike for you. But the current Scalpel, I think, would be a much faster bike on overall most trails than the older Scalpel, because the older Scalpel has like almost too much racer DNA to it, where it's built and designed like for like a World Cup racer. And while it's a great bike, you kind of sit on it and you feel like it's like a really stiff upright bike and you're like kind of sitting on top of this thing that's kind of skip you and bounce you around, which I think is a big thing. Nike racers and most people getting into mountain biking maybe might not have the best technical skills of all time. So a bike that can let them do more and is more capable kind of can let them focus a little bit more on their training and fitness, and also at the same time give them the confidence to try to start doing bigger features as well, which could also be that side of things.
So having discussed frames, you kind of led into this already with suspension.
Yeah.
The two big ones out there, Fox and RockShox.
Absolutely.
A question I've had several times is, do you have a strong preference between the two?
I do.
So what is your preference as of today?
My preference as of today is RockShox. I'm currently running Fox in my ZFS because it's gold, and that is like the stupidest thing to say. But when I bought the frame, I had like some like wolf tooth parts that I could put on it that were like the espresso colorway. And I think that would look really good with Kishima. So I had run Fox stuff in the past and I was like, oh, I'm going to get like a Fox 34 step cast and Fox suspension. It's going to be great. I'm going to love it. And I came off of a current gen RockShox Cid and I actually noticed a pretty big difference. I think RockShox versus Fox matters less in like the trail bike side of things and like bigger travel. They're a little bit more equal. But I think currently in the cross country world, RockShox is taking over Fox by like a storm.
Really?
Yes. I notice a significant difference when I'm descending, especially descending is really where you notice it. And like descending hard on a Fox 34 versus a Sid is a noticeable difference. A RockShox Sid in a rough descent is much more supportive. It is a more supportive fork. It sits more in its mid travel while the Fox sits higher up in its travel, which can make you feel like you're diving into your suspension too much. It makes you feel too over the front end in a descent, while the RockShox keeps you farther back. Fox suspension also makes more noise. You get the more noises from your fork and shock, even brand new, from Fox over RockShox. RockShox suspension is like noticeably quieter. And also the biggest thing for me is the Fox 34 step cast is not as stiff as a Sid by a long shot. I also preface this in case people don't know, there's a Sid and a Sid SL. I'm talking about the normal Sid, not the Sid SL. It is a little bit thicker in the stanchion, and that's what like most 120 mil cross country bikes
use. So this is actually a good point. I've talked about this with people before. There are still some cross country bikes that run 100 mils of travel. So actually a lot of them, like both the Blur and the Cervelo that we've been talking about, have
like 100 mil
100 and 120 mil versions. So talking about this, in RockShox lineup, you have the 100 mil fork that has a 32 millimeter stanchion, so like a little
and
skinnier.
They have a 110 version of that same fork.
They have 110 version of that same, and then they have the 120 mil version that has a 35 mil stanchion.
35 millimeter stanchion. That's a big difference.
So you gain some weight, but you also gain a lot of
barely
stiffness.
I mean, Fox did update the 34 step cast with the last like I think month and a half, 2 months, and it did get lighter because they changed the damper system in it. But before they changed the damper system, the RockShox was a thicker stanchion and still lighter than the current 34. The 34, now that they land it, lighten up the damper, they're pretty close in weight. It's like 1,476 grams for a Sid versus like 1,435 for a Fox 34. So they're pretty close together, still like 50 grams. But the current RockShox, it's still an incredibly light fork into 120 mils. But the biggest thing I think about that is, it, to me, from riding, because I own a trail bike with a big stanchion, and I owned a trail bike last year that had a Fox 36 on it. The Fox 36 and a RockShox Sid and 120 mils of travel feel about just as stiff as each other, which is crazy.
Really? So the Sid compared to like Fox's hard, you know, all mountain like fork that would go on like a 150 mil travel bike, they feel similar to you
in stiffness wise. Which I think is actually pretty crazy. I think the Fox 34 step cast especially is like a pretty flexy fork, and so is the normal 34. I've had a lot of customers like kind of going like who have had Santa Cruz tall boys who ride them pretty dang hard, like they're not like they do a lot of climbing, which is why they got the tall boy, but they descend really hard as well, and have complained feeling flexiness in their fork from a Fox 34, and they want to go to a Fox 36, and instead of going to a 36 and getting all that way, I say try a Pike, which is a 35 mil stanchion from RockShox.
It's like the next fork
It's the next fork from the Sid, and it's fixed all their issues. I think RockShox forks are stiffer in general. They use thicker sidewalls as well.
Are there any things that Fox is winning on?
Fox has a more off-the-top soft feel. The travel off the top of its feel does feel better. And the other thing Fox is winning on, I mean, number one, they got gold forks. That's sure. cool. Yep. Everybody loves gold. Is also the way the fork moves through its travel. As the fork moves through its travel, a Fox fork moves through its travel more smoothly, and it feels like it's more plush is the air quote people term like to use, which I think the other difference is. And that, I think, is something that's awesome, but matters more to me on a big travel bike and not on an XC bike. On an XC bike, I'm looking for suspension that can be pushed harder because it's a bike of low travel already. You want it to be capable because it's low travel, and RockShox gives that to me. I think Fox and RockShox were way more equal like 2 years ago. I think Fox was winning the game for a while. RockShox in the last 3 years has really, really stepped up their game. They had the bright blue Sid from 2021 to 2022. That was fantastic. And then into 23, that was fantastic. Amazing fork. And then last year, they released the blue Crush Sid, the new 2024 Sid, which they machined out the stanchion a little bit, new damper. That even like took it up even more of a notch. Both those the last two iterations of Sid fork have been fantastic. Not only do I think they have better mid-stroke support and can handle a lot more abuse, I think they also can do better. Even though technically, if you look at like manufacturer recommendations, the Fox fork needs to be serviced less than a RockShox fork. The RockShox is like every 50 hours you're supposed to do a seal kit service. You can let a RockShox fork run for like a while and it feels fine. Like if you're not servicing your suspension all the time, which I don't, even though I should.
Most people don't,
especially Nike racers. I think that's a really big thing. If you're a Nike racer and you're putting in a ton of hours and you're riding all the time, if you were actually servicing your suspension when you're supposed to, your fork would be going into the shot to have its seals taken out and replaced and reserviced like every 3 weeks. That's so much.
Yeah.
I think if you're like actively riding your bikes, if you're doing like a service like maybe every like two two times a season, maybe more if you ride a lot, that's fine. Okay. I think you're doing fine.
So maybe I've gone backwards here, because I do actually want to go back a little bit. Think you'd agree. No, it's okay. I should have asked this first. I think you'd probably agree that suspension set up right is the best suspension, and that's the most important thing.
Absolutely.
Most people don't ever play with their suspension. I think like the majority of people we sell bikes to don't maybe even realize.
Yeah, we set it up for them when it goes out the door, and they never change it again.
So there are a few things that you can change. You've probably seen there's a little air shaft on your fork that you can put air into. Like you screw a shock pump into it. There's like a lockout dial. There's a little dial on the bottom that has a rabbit and a tortoise on it. Walk me through maybe just like the very basic, like how do you set up your suspension for you?
So personally, how I set up my suspension is I set it up for somebody who's bigger than me, pretty much flat out. I ride XC bikes pretty hard.
Okay.
I've taken my Cervelo down some things that like, I've like come down on a couple of trails and like riding next to people on enduro bikes and like, what are you doing here? Which I kind of get. I shouldn't be there on that bike. But I ride my bikes pretty hard and I want my bikes to be able to handle descents more aggressively. And I also want them to be efficient on the uphill, which actually in terms of suspension is a win-win. If you ride descents really, really hard, you might have a tendency to bottom out your suspension, which means that you might want to put more air pressure into your suspension to keep yourself from bottoming out, which in turn also makes your bike not as plush on the uphill and gives you a better platform to pedal on. So it's kind of a win-win scenario if you actually like to ride your bikes pretty hard.
So how do you decide how much air pressure should go into is there a certain number to look for?
So there is kind of a number to look for me personally, but it took some testing. I rode my bike on the exact same test loop. Like it was a short loop, and this is everybody find a loop that works for them. Find a loop that simulates what you're riding and racing on and something that you can do maybe 2-3 times in 45 minutes. And every single time I did that loop, I would change one setting. Never change more than that. If you change too many things, you're not going to notice what changed. You have to be able to isolate it. And I did that for like 4 days. This is like one of the nerdiest things I think I could like admit to doing, but I did this for 4 days in a row. I tested air pressure super high, air pressure super low. I tested high rebound, low rebound, and tested like different compression settings. That was on the trail bike. On the XC bike, you don't actually have a ton of compression settings. It's mainly just rebound and air pressure, and tested all those things again and again and see what actually works best. I've done the same thing for tire pressure as well. I currently weigh 140 pounds. My Forex PSI is set for somebody who weighs 160. Same thing in my rear shock.
Is that just going off the little guide on the
fork? That's going off the guide in the fork. So personally, I run my air pressure, my fork high, so that weight stays high in your travel and doesn't break super far in. XC bikes are low on travel. They're only 100 to 120, which means that you have less travel to blow through. So it gives you a little bit more breathing room to like take bigger hits and not bottom out all the way. And it makes a more efficient suspension for climbing and rolling stuff anyways. The other thing to go along with that is like rear shock setup.
Because on rear shocks, there's usually not like a little
there's thing not a guide that says this is actually pretty easy. This gets way harder in like trail bikes, but for most people listening to the podcast, we're just riding XC bikes. This is super easy. 90% of XC bikes use a flex day design over the last 4 years, I would say, and so most of those shocks, if you actually run the numbers on like what manufacturer recommendations are, it's usually 105 to 108% of rider weight.
Okay.
So like, let's say, and most people can average it out. Like if you're racing, maybe do 110. If you like a little softer ride, do 105. But me personally, because I like a more firm feel and I also ride my bikes more aggressive, I want a little bit more air pressure in there. Number one, I run one volume token in my front and rear shock. Volume tokens, for those who don't know, take away some of the volume inside your fork and rear shock, which means as your suspension ramps up, it is less linear and more progressive because as the air compresses, it's harder to push down on
basically
it.
Basically, like it gets stiffer as you move through the travel.
It gets stiffer as you move through the travel, which helps prevent bottom you out. From bottoming out. Yeah, right. So I run my air pressure like firm, and I also run volume tokens from the rear. The rear shock, I run 115% of my weight.
Wow.
So I only run like 16-17% sag in my rear shock.
So we say sag because we tell people all the time, you set sag, you basically put your body on the bike in the neutral position, see how far, and that's what that little ring
that's what the ring is.
So you're not even really, you're just kind of seeing, you're not like getting on your bike and seeing where your sag is and then adding or subtracting air. You kind of just like know, I want about 110, about 115% of my body weight.
Of my body weight in terms of PSI, and that works. See, that's very unique to cross-country bikes, so you can kind of just do that. Most trail bikes, you actually have to fluctuate with sag a little bit more. But on XC bikes, because they're more efficiency-based, you can, and also their suspension design is almost all the same because they all run flex days, you can kind of just do that. I would say a good starting point for anybody who's like riding XC bikes casually would be trying to run like 27% sag in the rear. And then, because I always start with a sag point and then I move on from there. But 27% sag in the rear, racers might want to run 20-25% sag in the rear and then go from there. I run my sag pretty aggressively, but not everybody.
So you mentioned most bikes are flex days. Let's, for the people listening to this who are riding a Pivot or the Ibis or...
Yeah.
Hopefully Mondraker soon, because that'd be cool. Where they don't
Mondraker's
use,
awesome.
I know, right? I want that. Where they don't use the flex day, they have, I just say, like more sophisticated, complicated, involved suspension designs. That trick doesn't work, right?
It doesn't work quite the same way, no. Bikes with a like more legitimate suspension setup should run a little bit more sag because they're not quite as stiff in the rear. The suspension actually has like a breakaway force, I would say, because the way the linkage moves means that there's a certain amount of force needed to get the linkage to actually start moving versus the flex day, which is constantly soft and bouncy. Because of that, you can actually run a little bit more normal sag and be fine. So like if you were on something along those lines, you might want to run as a normal average rider riding those bikes, like 28% sag, and a racer, maybe 25% sag. So a little bit higher than like I would say the actual sag number is a little bit higher than a normal XC bike. So that would be like 107% of rider weight.
So moving on to the next, and this one I don't think we spent as much time on, because you'd maybe agree, SRAM versus Shimano drivetrains. Is this something you think about as much as suspension or as much as frame? Because I've kind of told people, I'm like, I don't know that I have an enormous preference. If my bike came with one or the other, I'd kind of...
I do have a preference.
What is your preference
right now? But I don't think it matters as much, to be 100% honest with you. I would say from low to mid-range drivetrain, Shimano takes a cake
Dior, SLX, XT?
Around XT area, yes, I would say Shimano takes a cake because it's reliable, works well, easy to set up, easy to run with. Works and it stays working for a while, and it's, I think the biggest thing there is reliability. It can take a beating and you don't really have to do a whole ton with it, it just kind of works. Setup's not quite as easy on Shimano stuff. SRAM stuff's easier to set up out of the gate, especially mechanical, but the Shimano stuff does take more of a beating. I think mid to high range, I'm pretty almost only SRAM.
Really?
Yeah. I think I'm number one. There's not an electronic mountain bike group set out from Shimano, and
yet.
I say if you yet,
but
if It'll you, happen. But I mean, it's been years,
yeah,
and they still
SRAM's
haven't
been doing Axis since
2019. They've been doing it for 5 years, and Shimano still has not come out with an electronic mountain bike group set. Or they did, but they haven't come out with a modern one with 12 speed. I think on super high-end drivetrains, if I had to choose high-end drivetrains, I would be perfectly fine with Shimano. I think a Shimano high-end drivetrain is great. I still think they function well, but like if I'm not sponsored, I have freedom of choice and I can do whatever I want, and like price to me is the same, I'm definitely going SRAM.
Okay.
I think SRAM's more reliable, deals with dirt better. The Hyperglide system in Shimano that lets you shift underneath power, which is a great system and it works really, really well, also means that the chain links and the cassette and everything is a little bit tighter in terms of tolerances, which is why it lets you do that. But that also means that it doesn't function as well in dust and dirt, which actually does make a difference. And that actually makes enough of a difference that I don't know how many people here are like super like mountain bike nerds, but if anybody's familiar with like the White Room Trail, current like fastest known time attempts, because things got heated there for a second and Peter Stetna got it, Keegan Swenson had it, Peter Stetna stole it, and then Keegan Swenson got it again. At the time of that FKT event, Keegan Swenson took it by, it's like less than 16 seconds.
It was
over,
really tight.
Over 5.5 hours, it was less than 16 seconds, which is wild. Keegan Swenson was on SRAM. He ran X01/XX1 wireless shifting, and Peter Stetna was on Shimano. Peter Stetna, during his attempt, pulled over twice to lube his chain because it was Hyperglide and it doesn't deal as well with dirt. That's so crazy to me that drivetrain sponsor could have been the difference in that record.
Interesting.
There's a chance that Peter Stetna on SRAM could have taken it from Keegan Swenson.
So just to clarify, I assume you're not saying that like stay away from Fox, stay away from Shimano, but
no.
All things being equal,
no.
You right now prefer a bike with, like on the high end, a bike with RockShox
and SRAM.
And SRAM. But so maybe then maybe this
Fox
is
a... and Shimano stuff, I think I need to reiterate, yes, Fox and Shimano stuff is incredibly good.
Yeah.
I really don't have anything against it. Like, especially it's like you can also usually get Shimano to high-end drivetrains for cheaper than SRAM, which I think is a big factor. Yeah. I tend to find my SRAM is a little bit more reliable. Like it's kind of like as a like somebody who has to I get off of work, right, and I go ride my bike. The more time I have to spend working on said bike, the less time I have to ride. If you're limited in like that, if you work on your own bike, so i.e. time working on your own bikes is time you're not riding and training, that makes a bigger difference. So set it and forget it stuff to me is a little bit more of a bigger issue. SRAM shifting doesn't, every shifting will go out of whack eventually. You sure. have to get tune-ups. That's just the way things are. Shimano tends to detune itself faster than SRAM. So that's kind of a big thing for me, which is why I tend to go with SRAM more. And also power meters are so much easier to get on SRAM over Shimano. And so if you train with power, getting a power meter on SRAM setups is so much easier, especially now with every crank coming from the transmission lineup and SRAM being 8-bolt. It's so simple.
So that's another question I have. With the SRAM systems, you had Axis, which we say, they have mechanical systems, right? Which is I run mechanical SRAM. Then you had the Axis systems, which were the Bluetooth that a lot of people have had.
That's what I'm currently running.
Recently, we had the transmission stuff come out, which is a new version of the wireless stuff.
Yes.
That uses the universal derailleur, and basically your derailleur bolts directly onto your axle. Like it's like, do you, really quick, maybe just give the 411 elevator pitch on transmission. And then my question is it worth, if you have Axis, do we need to be upgrading transmission? Do we choose transmission over Axis? Because both are still kind of out there. I do think transmission is replacing Axis, that Axis will go away.
When they released transmission, they did like a press release to all the shops, right? And they said, hey, this is what we're releasing. This is everything to go along. But they did that probably about a week and a half, maybe even longer, maybe 2 weeks before they released the drivetrain. I was the one who sat in that for Contender and took all the notes on it. And during that meeting, they were pretty heavily saying that transmission is not replacing Axis, is an addition to the SRAM line. I don't know how long that's going to ring true. Maybe a year or two from now, they'll say, okay, fine, we're now getting rid of Axis because transmission's been out for so long. But as of right now, they're pretty reliant on saying that transmission is an additional drivetrain to Axis and it's not replacing it. And I think a big part of that is because the standard Axis drivetrains can still be put onto any bike whatsoever.
Right. So until more bikes, because basically... Yeah. It's this universal derailleur I talked about. That's a new standard that not every frame has.
It's been around for like 7 years at this point, but really only every frame has only actually had it for like the better part of the last three.
Okay.
Or two.
So what is the performance advantage of the transmission drive?
So,
how does it feel different on the trail?
So transmission from actually riding on the trail, the biggest things you're going to notice is how it's under power, load under power, which I think is the biggest thing from them. As like, they're like, you can sprint as hard as you want. And I have tested this. And like you can sprint as hard as you want and put the power down on it, and it does not miss shift. It might be a little bit louder. Like you can get like the ping, ping, ping if you're like sprinting. But it does not miss shift. It shifts best, honestly, pedaling around 200 watts to 250 watts, which is kind of a lot. I mean, and that's like a pretty, like that's like a tempo effort for a lot of like Nika racers. That's where it shifts the best. So it's the best. And so in like in an XCO race, especially like short track or XCO races that are fairly fast paced, not letting up on the power like you have been on every other system your entire life, like taught how to remember to lift up the pedals a little bit before you shift so you don't like miss shift. Not needing to do that can make or break a race. That's really, really fast paced. That's more of like a racer's kind of side of thing, is like how I think transmission, honestly, its best application is on e-bikes, because e-bikes, like, you can just shift underneath power and it wouldn't matter.
Right.
For racers, the big thing is shifting under power. The other thing is that is not super talked about, which I think is a big deal. If you are buying a new bike and transmission versus Axis is a thing for you, something to keep in mind is that transmission cassettes and chains have like double the wear life of normal Axis. They are way harder and more durable. And like they're like claiming, SRAM's claiming you can get like, you know, 4,000, 5,000 miles out of an Eagle transmission chain. While the standard Eagle chain was only like, it was like half that. If you're properly lubing and like maybe even if you're waxing your chain, you can get that many miles out of a normal Eagle chain, no problem. Like out of a normal XO1 or XX1 chain, you can get a ton of miles out of those anyway.
But all things being equal,
supposedly the equivalent transmission chain, T-type chains, have twice the wear life. The other big thing for transmission for me is the durability. And I kind of scoffed at that. I was like, yeah, it's more durable. And they had all the videos like people jumping on it and like trying to break it. Yeah. Trying to break it. And yeah, it's more durable. I think I've seen this firsthand to the point where it was actually, this is the first, I already had Axis when transmission came out. So I just remained riding on my Axis. I think if you are on current Axis and you want to upgrade your transmission, it's not 100% worth it if you're on current Axis. If you're on mechanical and you want to go electronic, transmission I think is worth it.
Do it, right.
But yeah, but if you're on current Axis like X1 or XX1 and there's nothing really wrong with it, then I would just stay where you are. Mm-hmm. But like, let's say something broke and you would have to switch anyways and maybe go transmission. But, sure. I was riding in PCMR like a week and a half ago, 2 weeks ago. It was the day I was riding with you.
Yeah.
I was right after you left and came back to Salt Lake. I still hit some laps with a couple of people. We started doing some more sketchy trails. There's this secret trail off this underside of another trail that I will not name because it's supposed to be secret. But the nickname of the trail is called Moose Knuckle. And there's this one really hard right-hander that when I ridden 2 weeks previously, was pretty well packed in. It was nice and smooth. You could take it pretty hard. Came to it the same time on my XC bike into this right-hander, and the berm was pretty much blown out, but not visually blown out. It was just noticeably. So I went into the corner. My front wheel just washed through the corner. It's a pretty steep, like, loamy trail, so there's not a whole ton of support in those corners. And so I went down on the right side pretty rough, and I bent my derailleur hanger like crazy. The two people behind me who did not see me crash are on transmission. They both crashed in the same spot. It was really entertaining.
Yeah,
we were all fine. Both people on transmission, perfectly fine. They went on, continued the ride, no shifting issues. I didn't realize my derailleur hanger was bent. We get in the next climb, and I shift into my granny gear, and my derailleur hanger was bent inwards, and I threw my chain into my spokes. Yeah, which is absolutely.
Really, 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 really bad.
Yeah, and it was the first time I had done that on a bike in a while, and I was like, oh, my derailleur hanger is so bent.
Right.
Luckily, my bike is UDH, so I just picked up a new UDH and threw it on there, and I was good to go in like a day. It was perfectly fine. But that is something like that. Had that been a race, the rest of the ride, I just kind of kept riding. I am limited to around 3 gears that like worked without clicking or jumping. In a race scenario, that would have sucked. Racing on only 3 gears, or in your case, maybe 2 gears that work correctly without skipping around, I think is like a really big thing. And it was noticeable. I think the reason I was like, oh, transmission would have fixed this, is because the two people behind me who crashed on transmission had no issues on their shifting whatsoever.
Right, because there is no derailleur hanger.
There is no derailleur hanger to bend. Mine totally bent. Okay. I normally was like, yeah, your derailleur hanger doesn't bend on transmission, but how often are you really bending derailleur hangers? And then I like said that remark to a customer like 3 days previously, and then bent my derailleur hanger like 3 days after.
Karma gotcha.
That's what I get for saying that, right?
Right. So the best drivetrain in the world right now is transmission.
An extent. It is definitely more durable, and it is definitely like shift center power. It's more durable, all those things like that. Something to keep in mind is if efficiency is purely your goal, and you maybe you're doing something you're not going to crash on. Maybe you're doing, again, like we say to talk about White Rim Trail. White Rim Trail, the chance of you actually crashing on White Rim Trail is not super high. That's not a super technical like place to do, and maybe you really, really want to go fast. Technically, transmission has a flat top chain, which has more drag than old Axis. Older Axis is more efficient.
And
then transmission.
Shimano's even more efficient than that.
Even more efficient than that until it gets dirty.
Okay.
Until it gets really dirty. Shimano's not more efficient once it's dirty, but clean, Shimano's more efficient.
Right.
So that is something
giving up some watts.
Yeah. So that's something that SRAM doesn't talk about because they don't want to talk about it because they want to sell their transmission. And something that, I guess, as an employee, I probably won't talk about in story. But here, yes, transmission is not as efficient as normal Axis. Normal Axis saves roughly, I think the quotes I was seeing from some companies doing third-party testing were saying 2.5 to 3 watts over transmission. Flat top. If you're waxing, that's less of an issue on your chains. I bet you could do a whole podcast on chain waxing.
Genuinely have.
Awesome. Yeah. But if you're waxing your chain, transmission is pretty still, it's efficient. It's a good system. I mean, bicycles in general are actually super efficient machines. Like there's like, I was seeing some like quote somewhere that like, I can't remember what study this is, but like the bicycle itself as a machine is like 95% efficient or something like that.
And like an internal combustion engine is like 20% efficient.
Yeah, like bicycles are crazy efficient in terms of like actual loss between your pedal output to like the measurement they're talking about in terms of efficiency is how much power you're putting out through your feet versus how much power is actually reaching the ground or like the rear cassette. And that loss. So that doesn't take into account traction or anything because that becomes a bigger loss. But the actual just like loss between the sole of your foot to your cassette is like 95% of like efficiency rating, which is really, really good. Transmission's not as efficient as Axis, but how much does that really matter? It could be a whole nother argument. Sure. But It is not technically as efficient. I would say if you are buying a new bike and you're going off your old bike, I think transmission is worth it to an extent. How much are you willing to pay for it? You can usually get Axis bikes from the previous model year for crazy good prices. Right. And Axis is still a really good drivetrain.
Right.
So like, say the difference between you going transmission and not going transmission is like $500 on a $6,000 bike, then that's not that big of a deal. But let's say the same bike of the exact same caliber, like let's say you're looking transmission bike, that's $7,000. And then there's another bike that's got all the same components on it, except it's Axis. Normal Axis instead of transmission, but it's like $1,500 cheaper.
You're going with
that's like access, I'm gonna go with the normal access, right? Sure. You can use that $1,500 for like, oh, I'm gonna get a power meter.
Right.
That's gonna make a bigger difference to your training in the long run.
Sure.
So I think that is something to think about.
Last one for you, last section here for today. Tires. I think people don't think about tires enough, and I'm including myself in that. I think a lot of people know to look for, like, I think a lot of people could probably differentiate a cross-country tire from a downhill tire just by looking at the tread.
Yeah.
Tread aside, what are the other parts of tire? Like, we talk about the durometer, the softness of a tire, the TPI. We talk about compounds and sidewalls and all that. Could you give the kind of, I think really people on this team generally don't know almost anything about that. What is your beginner entry level definition of all those terms and what to look for and why they matter?
So TPI stands for threads per inch. It is the casing inside of the tire.
So you say casing, what is the casing?
So the casing is the actual like sidewall and base of a tire. The tire's tread pattern is put on top of the casing, but the casing and the sidewall are like pretty much the same thing. Every tire casing has a layer of thread, some usually Kevlar, sometimes other materials that are built in, and there's a rubber layered over that, and then there's tread pattern laid on top of that. That is your casing. Threads per inch refers to the threaded cloth layer of the casing, how many threads are in there. The higher thread count, the more supple the casing is, the more supple the tire is, the more supportive it is to the rider, but also and the faster it is, way more rolling resistance. Less rolling resistance. But also the less durable it is. The way to think about it, the more threads there are, the less space there is for rubber, which means that it becomes less durable because rubber is more cut resistant than the threads are. So
durability
are.
Like wear life or puncturing?
Punctures. Wear life in like high TPI tires is less, but not crazy. So something to like think about there is race tires should be higher TPI if the race can allow for it. If you're doing a crazy gnarly race, avoid super high TPI tires because you run the risk of puncturing and ruining a race. You see XCO riders like on the World Cup courses use crazy high TPI tires, sometimes even like custom made tires, but that's because they have somebody waiting for them in the pits who can swap them a wheel in case they flat. And that is noticeable. I mean, like Nino Schurter flats like what, every six races, every five races? It's a lot. It's kind of a lot. But he does flat a lot because he's running super high TPI tires. Nika racers who don't have a mechanic waiting for them in the pits who can swap them in a wheel.
Probably shouldn't do that.
High TPI tires can make a difference on like smoother courses. But if you're running a gnarlier course, don't risk a flat.
Okay.
The other saying there is the casing itself. They'll usually – different companies will have different definitions for how thick that casing is. The thicker the casing, the more puncture protection you have, the more weight you have as the downside. There's a pro and a con to that. And then tread pattern. And then there's compound, which is the softness of the rubber. Different compounds will give you softer rubber. Softer rubber has more rolling resistance, but then has better grip in corners and better braking traction. And then tread pattern itself also affects the bigger your knobs, the more rolling resistance, but better traction, braking traction, by slower rolling resistance. That's kind of like the brief overall thing. My kind of thought on tires usually is, on 95% of Nika courses, run a Maxxis Aspen.
Yeah.
It's pretty easy in terms of Nika. Run a Maxxis Aspen, or if you can find them, Pirelli XCRCs. Pirelli XCRCs are awesome tires, and I love them. That's just Nika courses. When you get to like Pro XCO courses and like XTC, the Pro XTC calendar, that can be more complicated because like the Fayetteville Arkansas course is pretty technical, and you also gets muddy, so you want to worry about that because Aspen doesn't clear mud well. But I would say overall, if you're just like looking at tires and you're trying to figure out what you want as an XC rider, you don't really need the highest puncture protection unless it's a training tire. Maybe like if you're going Maxxis, maybe they have like XO, XO Plus, double downhill. you don't really need to worry about double down or downhill. But as like an XC rider, most of the time you're going to be racing and training on XO, but occasionally let's say like, oh, I'm doing training and I don't want to flat my training. You might put XO Plus on the rear.
What Max's tires are available with XO Plus?
In the cross country tread pattern, really just the Recon. That's about it.
Which is already a fairly gnarly tire.
It's already like almost like it's like a light trail tire at that point. Yeah. And you can get the Forecaster, which is technically a heavy cross country tire. Max has classifies it as a down country tire. Thanks Mike Levy for that definition, but down country is now a thing. But the Forecaster, you can get an XO Plus. But I think there are more tire manufacturers who do bigger casings like that. So Pirelli, the XCRC, like I mentioned, super similar to the Maxxis Aspen. The Pirelli XCRC is my go-to race tire for like the last 2 years. I love that tire. Fantastic tire. Kind of hard to get in the United States.
I sold two today.
It rolls. We have some at the shop right now because I ordered some.
Selling your tires.
Well, probably. No, I ordered some, and to fit order minimums, we have to order a certain amount. And also Oliver Scanchi ordered some, so Nick had to order more tires to fill our order minimum. But the Pirelli XCRC can be kind of hard to find in the United States, but it's a fantastic tire. So the thing about the Pirelli XCRC is that rolling resistance is about the same as an Aspen. They roll pretty similar to each other. It's a little bit faster, but not crazy. If any geeks are here like to look at rollingresistance.com, it does roll slightly faster, but not something crazy. But it hooks up in corners better, and it's more predictable. The Aspen's a little bit unpredictable sometimes in how it slips. The Pirelli still slips. I mean, it's an XC race tire. It still slips all the time, but it's predictably slippy, which you can kind of let it identify. The big thing with the Pirelli, though, is that you can get it in two casings. They make a light wall and a pro wall in the XC. And so they have the light wall, which is like their dedicated race one. It's lighter, more supple. Same TPI as the Pro Wall, but it's a lighter compound. It's a lighter casing, but it has less puncture protection. And then they make the Pro Wall, which is slightly thicker and has better puncture protection. The Pirelli XCRC in the Pro Wall version is still like 30 grams lighter than a Maxxis Aspen per tire. So you can get, like, in theory, better puncture protection. I don't actually know where the Pro Wall lies in terms of, like, compared to XO. But it's still, like, significantly lighter, and it's supposed to be, like, a thicker casing. So that's what I've been running for, like, the last 2 years. I love the Pirelli XCRC. But my kind of thought is I train usually on bigger tires. I'll usually train on either, like, a Maxxis Forecaster because I like to do stupid stuff when I train, and I'll end up on, like, gnarly terrain and, like, stuff I shouldn't be on that when training on an XC tire can get kind of sketchy, and I race on a Pirelli XCRC. That's, like, my go-to tire setup.
Boom.
2-4 on everything.
2-4 on everything.
Everybody should ride a 2-4, no matter what, unless you're in mud.
Bada bing, bada boom.
Bada bing, bada boom.
Well, Isaac, we're overnight. That went by really fast for me. I could do this all day.
Next time I need to drive across
the country, I'm taking you along, because that'd be really fun. thank you so much for your time. I'll cut this if you want me to. If people are shopping for stuff, call Contender, ask for Isaac. Is that fair?
Yeah, I don't really care. If anyone needs to reach out with questions, I'm at the shop, like, usually anywhere to be 4 to 5 days a week. I'm there like 40 to 45 hours a week.
Isaac sleeps in the basement.
I sleep in the basement,
in a
actually.
Coffin.
And a little, yeah. I have a sleeping bag in the parts cage. I just kind of live in there. I don't ever leave the shop.
No, seriously, I think if anybody here is listening, yeah. Like, you know what? I want to build the most baller bike, not even across, because you have so many bikes, right? You know, like, you're the guy to talk to.
Yeah. And also, bikes don't have to be expensive. If you're trying to build a nice bike, but you don't want to spend a ton of money, but you're a cross-country racer, I can give you opinions. I mean, I've worked full-time in high school trying to support cross-country, not working at a bike shop, and you need to make a little bit more logical spending decisions. If you have questions, ask. I'm more than happy to answer. We also have a chat function on our website, which is answered by Joe here and me as well.
Sometimes. More often you, even when I'm supposed to be the one doing it.
Yeah, I forget sometimes. But those are usually answered pretty fast, and there's plenty of people at the shop who are more than happy to answer questions. So
good stuff. Well, thank you, Isaac.
Thank you.
We'll have another episode coming later this week. This one's a bonus for all you guys. Everybody go out and ride safe, and hopefully you'll
see
Isaac and I out in the trails. Wear a helmet.
Yeah.